Tech Talk. Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Coming up on this week's show, fresh from its global launch in Paris this week, we are hands-on with the new Huawei P20 Pro and we'll answer your tech questions. As MyFitnessPal tries to pick up the pieces from its data breach, we look at other running apps you should consider. And half of our older people have never been online. Are we letting them down and what can we do? As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you can tweet us with #TechTalkNT. But first, we're going to talk about running apps a little bit later on in the show with Claire O'Dowd. But what a week it was for MyFitnessPal. On Thursday evening / Friday morning, the company acknowledged that there was, in fact, a data breach and the information of some 150 million members, which is a big L number, were impacted. Their information was compromised by a hack that is thought to have happened in February. The company issued a statement to users. I received it on Thursday evening and it said, on March 25th, 2018, we became aware that during February of this year, an unauthorized party acquired data associated with MyFitnessPal user accounts. So the information that was acquired or impacted was usernames, email addresses and hashed passwords. The advice was to change your password very quickly. However, many of us, myself included, noted that it's not that easy to change your password on MyFitnessPal. I think you have to, the way I got around it was logging on with a web browser or via a web browser rather than the app. But the key message here is if you use the same username and password, the same email address and password for multiple things, go through all of your services and change the password. And you should never use the same password for more than one service, as you well know. But we're going to move on from that. And once again, I'm delighted to be joined by editor of TheEffect.net, John Riley. John, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, now thank you very much. So you were away on your Hollybobs.
Correct.
And then we met up in Paris this week.
We did, for the crack.
Yeah, just because that's what we do.
Pop over.
And not really, though, for anyone listening. We were in Paris for the global launch of the new Huawei flagship smartphone. And for those who don't know, people might think that these are very glamorous days and you're, you know, flown private jet. And there's elements of glamour.
There is.
But we were on a red-eye flight and I don't think I spoke to anyone for the first 4 hours of the day until we got there. And the launch was held in a beautiful building in the centre of Paris. And there was a presentation given about, Huawei's vision for the future and how they want to get better and how they want to be the best. And then they unveiled two new smartphones. So there's the Huawei P20 and then the Huawei P20 Pro.
Which is a real beast of a machine.
Yeah.
It's something else. They're really going as you said, they're guns blazing for the top guys, the Apple and the Samsung guys. Mm-hmm. And their camera just blows it out of the park, really.
Yeah, so we for those who don't know, so the P20 and the P20 Pro, these are kind of gun, as John says, go after the iPhone 10 and the Samsung Galaxy Note 8 and the S9 and S9 Plus.
Yeah.
The first things, so we'll talk about the Huawei P20 Pro because these are the phones that we've been given for review and I've been using it non-stop since Tuesday.
Yep.
And I love it.
Yeah, the battery now, that's the biggest.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That's 4,000 milliamp and they've got quite an impressive battery management software or system in place that, you know, I think you tweeted about it, that you had like 11 hours of usage and you were estimated another 20-something hours or something.
Yeah.
Crazy.
This is like, so again, because this is a flagship, the spec internally is massive. So as John said, you've got the 4,000 milliamp battery, I think there's 6 gigs of RAM, there's a SpeedL processor, all the memory that you'll need.
Yeah.
But the big thing, as I said, so I use it intensely and the headline is the camera. So there's 3 cameras on the P20 Pro.
On the back alone.
On the back alone. And like they take pictures better than my eyes can see.
Yeah, they've got an unbelievable ISO, meaning the low light is fantastic. It's got a specific setting called night mode, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. And if you tap this, it'll take maybe a 4 or 5 second exposure that you don't, you know, most people would be like, oh God, I might have to hold my phone steady for this, because if you're trying to leave a camera lens to capture as much light as possible. If you move the camera at all on most smartphones, if not all smartphones, it's going to be a blurry mess.
Yeah.
But they've created this new kind of software that'll let you capture a nice long 4 second, 5 second exposure and then stitch it all back together. And it's just it's the best low light I've seen on any camera to date.
My favourite thing of the press event, which was just sensational, but one of the head honchos at Huawei was on stage and was talking about the low light and was literally giggling with excitement as he showed an image captured by the Huawei P20 Pro, captured by the iPhone X and captured by the S9 Plus. And there was one image in particular. It was taken in a dark room, a completely dark room, and it was two carrots on a plate. And in the first image captured by the Huawei phone, you can see the carrots.
You can see the carrots.
And the iPhone X, you can't see the carrots.
It's a black photo.
And in the S9 Plus, you can't see the carrots. Yeah. And he was literally like, you can't see the carrots. Yeah, yeah, and it was just one of those
it should
mad
have been
moments.
A meme. Yeah.
Yeah, it should have been. But it's one of those times where you get that Huawei are so excited by what they're doing. The innovation in that company is unreal. If you think back, you know, I remember first mentioning Huawei, you know, years ago on the station, and we didn't know how to say it. We called it the Huawei because nobody knew it. It wasn't a well-known brand. And if you think of the likes of Samsung, Apple, Sony, LG, all these big well-known brands that we have in our homes and that you'd recognize their branding a million miles away.
Yeah.
If you think of how populated the Irish market is and the fact that Huawei managed to infiltrate that and become a serious contender for the number one spot, I mean, that's pretty good going, right?
In such a short amount of time as well. They commented on it quite a lot in the presentation, which is, you know, it's quite endearing of them to realize, look, we're the newbies. Mm-hmm. We're trying to break into this market. We're going to do the best we can. We're going to give, you know, the best partnership with Leica. You know, this is what's really knocking their camera phones out of the park and, you know, the latest specs on these cameras. So, like, they're giving it gung-ho and they're, like, really coming in thick and fast with some amazing innovations, like you said. A 20 megapixel monochrome, a 40 megapixel RGB sensor, and then an 8 megapixel 3x optical zoom, the best zoom on any phone. You know, I'm still blown away, like, when I'm using it day to day, that it just can go in so far and still retain so much detail that I know we're swooning over quite a lot, but it really is that impressive.
So this is, you know, first impressions, because what we'll do maybe next week is have a more comprehensive view, because at the moment we still are, you know, taking the plastic off the front of the screen because we've only had it a few days. But it does seem to be the one to go for if you are into photography.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful phone, and the thing that kind of struck me the most is that to buy it outright, it's $899, I think,
correct.
Which is significantly less.
Before nearly €400 less than, say, an iPhone X or even the top of the line S9 Plus. Yeah.
Like, that's a bit mind-boggling in terms of what you're getting for your money.
Yeah.
And it's quite telling. I know that I've banged on about my Samsung Galaxy Note 8 about a million times on this show.
Have you?
I have a Note 8. But since that time, since I've had this phone since Tuesday, I haven't actually taken my Note 8 out of my bag. I know.
Absolute drama.
I know. I'm cheating on my Note 8. And it's really annoying, but, like, I just think battery life is such an important thing to me. And as you said there, I tweeted it out the other day that I took my phone off charge. I think it was about 7:15 in the morning. I took it off charge. It was at 100%. Mm. And 11 hours later, I still had 30-something% battery and it was projected to last.
Yeah.
And what I really like, and it's very clever, is, as you mentioned there, the battery optimization software. So it'll tell you if a particular app is running in the background and draining your battery so you can just kill it.
Yeah.
So first impressions are, I love it, but will we do a proper review next week?
Yeah, absolutely. After more time with it, yeah, we find what's teething problems it may have then.
Okay, cool. But as I said, at first impressions, it looks good. But we have a ton of questions once again that we're going to run through. If you do have any questions for us, as always, you can email techtalk@newstalk.com. John, you missed the introduction of our hashtag. We have a hashtag now, don't you know?
What?
Yeah, it's called #TechTalkNT.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I know, right?
Who does this? Like,
they get paid millions of euro an hour. So use our hashtag. But okay, let's kick on with some of the questions. So this is a person who's looking for a replacement for the Pebble smartwatch. I have one since Pebble launched as a Kickstarter. Fitbit has purchased Pebble and is pulling support for Pebble in June. Can you recommend an Android smartwatch, John?
I can, because, well, it's a funny one, because Android smartwatches have had a tough time the last couple of years, not only with this whole kind of transition from Fitbit with Pebble and all that, but just in general, the manufacturers aren't really pushing it as they were at the start when, you know, when these kind of devices started first appearing. But I guess first off the bat, with Fitbit buying Pebble, they are kind of trying to push everyone onto their ecosystem, which makes sense. So they had the brand new Fitbit Ionic. Mm-hmm. So it's their new flagship smartwatch.
I was calling that the Iconic for, I'd say, a good 6 months on air.
I didn't want to call you out on it. I just said, look, I'll
did you know?
It. Yeah, well, I spotted it in one tweet. I was like, I'm not going to be an ass and try and correct her.
You should have corrected me.
I thought you would have seen it like after. Okay, I should have said something.
So I do apologise to the listeners I lied to for 6 months on News Talk. Yeah. There's no such thing as the Fitbit Iconic. I do apologise.
Close enough.
I'm just an idiot.
Yeah, so this is their kind of newest flagship. Old Pebble developers that have been developing, you know, the apps for the Pebble watches have been migrating over to this new watch and also have the users of the old Pebble watches. So it's a good transitional piece. They're trying their hardest to make sure that, you know, everybody has a reason to jump over to this new handset. You know, and for, because it's really well thought out and it's well implemented in terms of the software that's kitted out in it. It's not just an afterthought. You know, quick create something while, you know, because we've just bought Pebble.
Yeah.
It's a solid smartwatch. It does have GPS. It's got Fitbit Pay, and, you know, as I said, the ported Pebble apps. So if you've kind of favorite apps from before,
you can bring them across.
You can bring them over, or they're going to be on the device.
What kind of money are we talking about?
We're looking at about $309. Are there about Harvey
it's
Norman's?
An investment now.
It is, but look at any watch, respectably, you know, a decent watch, especially with tech as impressive as that built in, is going to kind of set you back a bit. It's a long-term investment.
And I suppose the fact that this listener is already a Pebble user and have been using it since, you know, it
existed. Yeah, this Kickstarter
they're dedicated to the smartwatch thing anyway.
So yeah.
Because I think what sometimes I wonder about are people go out and buy a smartwatch because they want one. And then at the end of the first cycle of the battery life, so when the battery goes dead, they put it on charge and forget to put it back on their wrist.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would just say, if you're just considering a smartwatch, maybe buy a cheaper one to begin with to see if you're going to be committed to the whole charging it thing.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, yeah, it's one of those changes in habit.
Yeah, exactly.
You need to charge your phone and your watch, and people just roll their eyes when I say that sometimes, going, oh, my watch is dead, I have to charge it, and they're like, what, don't you mean your phone? I was like, no, don't start. But personally, I've been using a Moto 360 second generation since 2015, I think,
and the battery looks very nice.
It's not, you know, it doesn't look like a smartwatch, but I think it's hard to come by now, and it is an older model, so you're probably better off focusing on the newer stuff for the more later specs and whatever. But as you said, if you want to jump into the lower price bracket market, these guys, TicWatch E, they're Mobviz. I want to get that correct. I think it's Mobviz. I haven't heard anyone say it out loud.
It's Mobvoi.
Mobviz.
Mobvoi.
Let's go with Mobvoi. So yeah, they've got their TicWatch E, and it's a good example of how affordable then doesn't mean you need a load of bunch of compromises.
Yeah.
So again, you've got GPS, you've got the new Wear OS operating system, and you've got the Google Play Store built in there so that you can download
your different apps.
Your different apps, you know, cool. The kind of messenger apps. And again, you know, this is starting at about €191.
So okay, that's more affordable.
Yeah, so that's a bit of an easier entry into the market.
Yeah.
And that you can get that at mobvoi.com.
Okay.
I hope I'm saying that right.
I would go with Mobvoi personally,
Yeah.
I'm the person who was saying iconic instead of
yeah,
iconic.
Sure. What do we know? Yeah.
Don't listen to me. And then third on your list, back to the Howie's.
This is the Howie's. This is the Huawei Watch 2. This is kind of the bells and whistles. This is the priciest of the three recommendations I have here, but a really good all-rounder, and it also looks quite sophisticated too. Again, kind of like my Moto Watch here, my Moto 360. It's, you know, it's hard to tell if it's a smartwatch from the outset. You can get a nice leather strap, and it just looks the part. And again, you got the new Wear OS. That's 2.0, which are nice GPS and NFC, but again, there's a bit of questioning over the NFC working here in Ireland, because you got to keep an eye on that, because sometimes it'll work in the States in terms of paying at kiosks and, you know, like we do with our tap to pay and stuff, but they have to still kind of officially confirm its availability outside of the UK and Ireland, or outside of UK and US.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, the NFC is near field communication, so it's kind of like the contactless thing on your card.
Yeah.
So you can do that with some of the watches. So I don't think that would be a massive breaking point for someone if they were looking for a nice looking smartwatch. So how much is this one?
That is the most expensive one, as I said, that's $349 in Currys PC World, but there is you have the chance to potentially get it cheaper online in other outlets, but you kind of have to do a bit of digging.
Do you know where I always go when I'm buying anything? It's pricebuy.ie.
Yeah, that pops up every time and it's great.
It's a really good website. So I have the app on my phone, and anytime I am buying, like I bought my niece a tablet for Christmas, and when I was buying that, I just went onto it. I noticed there was a tenner difference in the price of the tablets between different retail stores. So it's worth, you know, I know a tenner's not going to again break the bank.
Come on, Jess.
No, but seriously,
no,
it is. Like if you're in a shopping centre and all of these stores are in the one place.
And they're screaming at you, yeah.
Yeah, so you can literally just go in, and it's a case of going to the first floor or the second floor to buy your product, and you save a tenner.
Yeah,
so
true.
Obviously, if it's a bigger purchase, you could save more money, but I would highly recommend it,
Yeah.
Okay, so kicking on with the next question. I'm currently looking at purchasing a Note 8 or a similar phone. I still have my Note 3, which was a great phone.
That's unbelievable.
And love it, but it's getting old. Yes, it is. While I don't use the stylus or any of these features, I love the premium feel, large screen, quality camera and the future proofing that buying a top of the range phone provides. I've had my Note 3 for 4 years, which is mind boggling.
Yeah.
Would you recommend the Note 8? Also, what are the alternatives and what are the advantages over the Note 8? So,
yeah, I guess straight away we know that the Note 8 is a great choice. Jess,
because
can
I
attest.
Made it. Yeah. Yes. So the reason I went for the Note 8, and as I said at the beginning of the show, battery life is something that's very important to me. Now the Note 8 only has a 3,300 milliamp battery. There's a bigger battery in the S8 Plus.
Correct.
And the S9 Plus.
Yeah.
However, the battery optimization software on the Note 8 is sensational. I also like the feel of the Note. And if you are a Note user, as you say you are, the Note 3 was a good bit chunkier than the Note 8.
Yeah.
Like by a good shot. But you will notice a massive improvement in terms of performance.
Yeah.
From the Note 3 to the Note 8. Like camera, battery life, productivity, the screen.
Pretty much everything.
Everything has gone up 10 times. So I would be a fan of the Note 8. That being said, however, I'm loath to recommend another phone until I've had a full good whack with the Huawei P20 Plus.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to recommend. You know, obviously, you've got the Note 8. You've got some people kind of who don't use the stylus, like this person said they don't. You've got the brand new S9 Plus, which is very, very similar in specs and camera and whatnot. And it's got the dual aperture and all that. So that's extremely impressive too. But like we said, the new, what we are, you know, the golden child that we've been speaking about this morning, the Huawei P20 Pro.
If you're talking about future-proofing yourself and if you like the top-of-the-range phones, like, and again, I don't want to be bashing the S9 range, but I just feel that the S9 and the S9 Plus is not a future-proofed phone. I think it's an in-betweeny phone between the S8 and then what'll be the S10. I think, you know, as I said on the show 2 weeks ago, if I was going in to buy a phone and my options were the Note 8 or the S9, and to save the few quid, I would just go with the Note 8 because there's not a massive amount of difference.
Yeah.
Like, yes, you don't have the live or the AOR emojis.
No, that's...
And the camera is slightly better on the S9 and the S9 Plus. But to save a few quid and then you're due an upgrade then in 18 or 24 months anyway, I would go that way.
Yeah.
However, my gut is saying the Huawei P20 Pro is going to be the way to go.
Yeah, mine too.
There's plenty of other options as well. We've talked through them on previous shows. So if you go back in iTunes, Pocket Casts, or upon Newstalk.com, you can scan through. We did sort of a phone guide a few weeks ago, so you can have the rundown of all the ones for every price bracket, regardless of what you're after. And that actually ties into our next question. It's from a lady called Ruth. She says, hi, Jess. I'm looking for a phone that has a good selfie and front-facing camera. I would like to buy and use a ready-to-go SIM, something that doesn't cost a fortune. I mainly use this for phone calls and text and internet browsing. Mainly use my laptop for computer stuff. If you know a phone that might suit and any deals, thanks, Ruth. So Ruth is someone who knows exactly what she's looking for.
Which
and this
is great.
This is the dream. Somebody who says, I care about this, I don't care about this, I want it within a particular budget.
And that's kind of like a recommendation to anyone listening with their questions coming in. If you let us, the more information you give us, the better we can help you.
100%.
So I guess this is fantastic, you know, from Ruth. She knows what she wants and she knows what she uses her phone for. So and she wants something that's nice and pocket friendly. So to start off the bat, there is the Motorola E4 Plus.
Yes.
That's €180 right now in Argos. So that's on offer and that's a very good price. It's got a 5-megapixel selfie, but the big thing about this and a couple of the other handsets, another handset I have on my list here is that it's got a front-facing flash.
Oh, so you'll get that image.
So you'll always get a really good selfie photo. And, you know, because most selfies are taken on nights out or in darker indoor settings that, you know, you want to capture a nice group set, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
This front-facing flash is really going to kind of make it all the difference because no matter how good some kind of front-facing phones can be, if a flash is on there, it's going to really just make everything look a lot better. You've got your 5.5-inch 720p display, nice big screen. 16 gigs of storage, which isn't loads, but you can put a micro SD card in there and they're absolute pittance now. So you can buy
fab.
32 to 64 gigabyte SD card.
That's really good for less than 200 quid.
Yeah, exactly. So then we're moving on then to another recommendation. You've got the Samsung Galaxy J7. That's €229 in Carrefour Warehouse and other places. That's a 13 megapixel selfie camera, which is a step up from the Motorola. And you've got, again, a nice front-facing flash. So again, this is fantastic for night outs, like I said, that you can really make sure you capture picture everyone in the group or whatever you're taking a selfie of yourself. You got a 5.5-inch 1080p AMOLED. So again, a step up in the display there, resolution-wise and just kind of quality-wise. Mm-hmm. 16 gigs of storage again, but I get, you can also expand it with a micro SD card slot, which I would highly recommend if you're taking lots of photos.
So that's a little bit more expensive, but you do seem to be getting a decent upgrade in terms of a significantly better selfie camera. It still has the flash, a better screen, and then you can boost the memory.
It's got a micro SD,
Now, if she wants to go and spend $500
dollary-dos on a one, I recommended this phone previously on another show, the OnePlus 5T. It's $499 on OnePlus.net. This is a 16 megapixel selfie camera. There is no flash in the front, but it's got a fantastic 2.0 aperture. That's all bells and that's all fancy camera talk, but meaning your selfie is going to look fantastic coming out of this camera. It's got HDR, which is great. So if you're standing in front of a window, or like you know, people taking selfies with really bright backdrops and you're quite dark, the camera will be able to kind of capture both the dark image and the bright image and stitch them together, so you can get a nice balanced image with your selfies. And then you've got a nice electronic image stabilization, so you'll be then your pictures will be nice and clear. If you're holding your phone out far in front of your face, it'll potentially reduce a lot of the blur.
Fab.
Yeah.
Yeah, this phone, it's come up quite a few times. People are quite fond of the OnePlus range.
Yeah.
And then there was one other quick question, and the reason I'm throwing it in is because I was in a similar boat to this listener a wee while ago. They said, can you please recommend an e-reader for use in bed at night? I don't want a screen which will stimulate wakefulness and prevent sleep. So I went and bought an e-reader. So I did.
I saw that, yeah.
And I got the Amazon Kindle Paperwhite.
Yes.
And I think it was around £200. So I got it in Curry's PC World up in Carrick Mines. I didn't realise that Harvey Norman don't do Kindle, nor does Paracity.
I did not know that either.
Yeah, because again, I went up to Carrick Mines and I kind of, this is really lazy, but I don't drive. So I walked up and the first shop inside Carrick Mines is Paracity. And I was like, this will save me walking an extra 5 minutes. So I'll just go in here. They didn't have it. Then I went over to Harvey Norman. They didn't have it. So I ended up walking the long route. So whatever.
Lesson learned, yeah.
But no, the Paperwhite's really nice. And the reason I went for that one over the slightly cheaper one is because it's backlit. But it's not that really harsh light that'll keep you awake. It is...
white, is it?
Yeah, it's paper white. Yeah, so it's the e-ink thing. It's very soft on the eye, and they're very lightweight, and the battery life is incredible. I bought mine a few weeks ago, and I still haven't charged it.
That's great.
Yeah. Now I know people are going to be tweeting in, going, "Just read books." I still do read books, but if you're on the train quite a bit, as I tend to be because I don't drive, you don't want to be lugging books around with you. It's just nice to have something thrown in. So I would recommend the Kindle Paperwhite. People were talking about the Kobo range of e-readers as well.
Yeah.
Now I haven't had one of them, but a lot of people were recommending them to me. But if you are listening and you do have an e-reader, or also let me know where you buy your e-books from, because a lot of people had a lot of recommendations that I had never heard of.
Oh, like completely different outlets you'd never heard the name of.
Like literally never heard the name of. And there's also a mailing list that I signed up, and every day you get an email with books that are like 99p, so you get them for next to nothing, and they're titles that you'd recognise and authors that you recognise. Yeah. So if you do have any top tips for e-readers, do let us know. Techtalk@newstalk.com is the email address. But for now, John Riley, editor of TheEffect.net, thank you so much.
Cheers, Jess.
Tech Talk on Newstalk.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. As always, you can tweet the show using #TechTalkNT. Now, Eurostat figures published earlier this week showed the level of interaction our older people have with technology. And some of those stats were quite startling. I caught up with Justin Morin of Age Action, who gave me a bit of an overview of what those figures entailed.
Well, the majority of people over the age of 65 have literally never used the internet. It's about half of 65 to 74 year olds. And then when you go over 75, the number of people who've ever been online really drops off a cliff, frankly, and the government itself would describe it as almost statistically insignificant. So what we've seen there is a real problem with the number of people who are online, and it's even worse when you compare it to our EU neighbours. So in Ireland, for example, half of people over the age of 65 have never been online. In Britain, for the same statistic, it's 18%. So there's a big gap there in how Irish people are, I suppose, falling behind our EU neighbours, being able to access the internet, to get online, to use all the tools that many of us just take for granted.
Why do you think there is that disparity between Ireland and elsewhere in Europe? Is it that a generation of people were literally just forgotten about as we, the younger generations, embrace the digital age? Or are there other factors?
I think there's a combination of factors. When we're training older people, which is something Age Action does, the biggest barrier we find is a lack of confidence. So older people just have this sense that these new technologies are not for them, they're too complicated, they won't be able to learn it. As soon as they start, they're as capable as anybody else of picking it up. I think there's other issues as well in Ireland. Rural broadband is a serious problem, and a lot of older people live in the kind of areas just simply don't have broadband. Some of them might even come in, do a class and go home, and it takes 20 minutes to send an email, and they're just not going to keep up with it. I suppose the last factor is we there's a state scheme, digital grants for helping people to get online. There's not a huge amount of investment put into it. There are really, really long waiting lists. So you might have somebody who's an interest in going online. They come to an organisation, say, I'd like to do classes. We say, well, that's great, but you'll have to wait a few months before something can free up.
So in terms of the classes, that's something that you run voluntarily. So there's no cost to the people who take part. Is that correct?
Yeah, we rely entirely on volunteers, and you know, the volunteers are absolutely amazing. They give their time to train older people how to use computers, laptops, smartphones in some cases, tablets, whatever they want to learn, whatever they want to use. We've people in transition year schools, corporate partners, we've volunteers who come in off the street to do it. So they make it possible and ensures that we can provide the service for free. It's one-to-one training as well, which is really, really important, because we've had experiences with some older people. They've been in a class of 8 to 9 people and they've just felt a little bit lost. This way it goes at their own pace. You can focus on the issues that you want to be focused on. So if you want to learn Skype to talk to your grandchildren, you learn Skype and talk to your grandchildren. You don't have to focus on things that aren't what you want.
In terms of the benefits to the older people of using the internet, because very often when we talk about the internet and social media and that sort of stuff, it's almost seen as a luxury, you know, it's like you don't need social media. But for people who live in the rural areas you mentioned a few minutes ago, this can be the difference between an older person not having any contact with the outside world and then suddenly being connected, or somebody who maybe can't leave the house could now do their weekly shop online. There's very significant benefits to older people to having a certain level of digital literacy.
I actually think that's a really important point, is that we've moved from internet access being a luxury to it actually being essential, and particularly really for a lot of older people who might be living alone. You know, we've older people who, you know, can't access their bank because the local bank branch is closed. So now they need to do their bank business online. They're not able to do that. So they've got their IT literate relatives running their bank account, which is just very, very unsafe. And that was actually highlighted in a case earlier on this week as well. We've people who are, you know, cut off from friends and family. And there was research done in the United States which identified internet use as reducing loneliness and depression amongst older people, especially older people living alone, by more than 30%. So it really enables and empowers older people to access information, to do their services. And sometimes that information can be quite critical. I remember making the point to me recently that when Storm Emma hit, he was watching the TV and he was listening to the radio, and the government spokesperson would often end by saying, follow this website or this Twitter account. And he's sitting there going, I don't know what that information is because I can't get to it. So it's really, really critically important to access services, to be able to get information, and also to be able to enjoy it, you know, to be able to pursue new hobbies, to pursue new interests. We've older people who came to our classes and started businesses. They're campaigners on social issues. Or we've, you know, one older woman I know who uses Skype to teach her grandchildren in Armenia how to knit. So there's a huge variety of things you can use it for.
I spoke to that woman who teaches her grandchildren to knit, and she is an incredible lady because she went along to the classes, she learned how to do very basic things, and now that is a central part of her week and her life. And she showed me when I went out to her house to interview her before, she'd printed off recipes for baking and she gave me stuff because I told her I can't cook and she was horrified at me. But it's given her an extra lease of life. She said up until that point, it was an element of kind of just sitting around and waiting for the days to tick by. But this seems to be a vital resource that we all take for granted, and yet our older people are to a certain extent being left behind.
Yeah, I think, you know, it really opens up a whole new world to somebody to go online, to find the array of information, to find the things that you can do on there. That, you know, my own mother, for example, loves Wikipedia, and she's reading it and she's learning things and she's finding out new information. Then she's sharing it with me, and that helps, you know, build conversations. It helps build friendships and things like that. And I think it's we're so connected every day. The first thing you do is you switch on your iPhone or your tablet and you check Facebook, you check your messages, you check your emails. And we suppose we just assume everybody is like that. And the reality is we've so many older people who don't have any access to the internet. So communicating with them is differently. They feel feel that little bit cut off, and they see, you know, they read things in the newspaper about, you know, a flurry on Twitter and social media, and it's all very disconnected to them. They don't feel a part of it. And I think particularly as more and more service providers, especially banks is our experience, but others as well, as they try and push people online, more and more people are finding it difficult to access those services and creating the kind of problems we discussed earlier.
If you have, if someone listening to this has an older relative and they want to try and help them in some way, shape or form, they may feel, well, I'm not an expert. So, you know, how could I teach somebody how to use the internet? Are there basic things, basic starting points that we can start to teach the older people in our lives, the fundamentals, if they don't have access to volunteers such as Age Action?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to sit down and show them how straightforward and easy this is. Like, sending an email is not a particularly complicated thing to do, but you'd be surprised how intimidated people can be by doing it. So if you show them how you send an email, it's very straightforward. If you show them how to, you know, go to Wikipedia or how to Google something on the internet, once you show them and they realize, actually, this isn't as frightening as I thought it would be, then I think they're going to be much more likely to sit there and listen, and you talk through the actual steps that you take to actually do that. So those kind of simple tasks, I think people can learn. I think what's also important, we deal with a number of older people who have picked up the concerns about security and financial security and data security, and probably even especially now in the last couple of weeks, it's been in the papers again. So I think it's about explaining to them that the information you put out there, you know, they're not going to be able to find information off you. You know, it's only the information you put up there that they're going to be able to access. So if you don't want to go on Facebook, don't go on Facebook. If you don't want to go on social media at all, you don't need to do that. You just need to use it for the things that you actually want and that you actually get benefit out of. And I think that reassures them that they're not going to, you know, send an email and suddenly have their bank accounts raided.
And that is a big fear factor, not just with older people. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there, and some people just naturally aren't as tech savvy as others. And they do get intimidated when they use a new service or when they input their banking information. And that's not necessarily that means that they're a Luddite, because, as you said, in the last few weeks alone, there have been a number of cases that are of massive concern. In terms of the devices themselves, so if an older person does want to start using the internet or interacting with technology in some way, shape or form, are there grants to help them buy a device, or how do they get access to devices in their home?
Generally, what would happen to us, and actually we always get a spike in January because they've been given iPads or tablets for Christmas, but that's how they would get them. They would buy them themselves, or they would be given them as gifts, and they would come to us. What we often find is that especially the younger old people in their 60s, they might have used a PC or a laptop in their office, but they've never used a tablet. And I think that's where, you know, I suppose that's where digital communications is going now. So they want to go to a class to learn how to use a tablet and how that's different and how apps are different, how you download them and things like that. So in terms of the devices, they would generally buy them themselves, and they would come to us, and, you know, they would sit down with a volunteer. And some of them are easier to use than others, and some of them are more flexible than others. And I think it's about identifying the one that suits them the best and making clear that you don't need to do everything. You just need to do the things that really benefit you.
What's the danger point if we don't bring our older people up with us as technology develops? Because technology has changed unbelievably over the last 5 years, never mind the last 10 years. So what will happen if we continue to rush ahead, but we leave a generation or two generations of people behind?
In a word, isolation. Just more and more older people being socially isolated, being isolated from services, being isolated from state services, being isolated from banking services, commercial services, and just that sense that they would then, you know, I suppose, take into themselves of the entire world moving ahead and then being left behind and being forgotten about. And I think you're absolutely right, the technology is changing so fast that, you know, that there's a sense you do one of our computer classes and you're fine, you can go out now, you know how to use computers. But they change so much, and the technology changes so much. We'd often have people come in, they've completed a course and they've come back and said, I'm not sure how we did this, but I downloaded a virus. How do you clear out viruses? And things like that. So I think there'll always be a need for kind of level of training or services available. And you look at models in Britain, for example, where you have a helpline available to people who older people or people with mobility difficulties. So if they have a problem, they can ring someone. We don't have something like that in Ireland. So making that available, understanding, as you pointed out a little while ago, that this is now essential. It's no longer a luxury. And therefore, we need to provide a little bit of support to older people and other people as well, I think, who are that little bit isolated and need supports to get online.
And so if people are listening to this now and they're thinking, you know, they've a few hours a week, they'd like to help out with Age Action and become a volunteer to teach older people, as you said, the very basic things like sending an email or setting up an email account, what can they do? Can anyone be a volunteer?
Absolutely, anyone can be a volunteer, and please, please do get in touch. We will talk you through the training, we'll take you through it. Every volunteer we've done has said it's an incredibly rewarding experience. It's very positive for both people, and particularly we do a lot of we do connections with a lot of transition year classes in different schools, and they love, because they're showing an older person how to do something and they feel a real sense of pride about doing it. The older people love talking to the younger people, so it's a really enjoyable experience as well for everybody who's involved. And at the end, you've got something really solid. Somebody is now going to be able to shop online, they're going to be able to do their business online, and they're going to be able to email their relatives. And often you do that in the class and there's a little bit of excitement that I've just sent my first email to my grandchild or whatever.
So if people want more information, where can they find it?
Well, you can go to our website, ageaction.ie, or if you're one of the many people who are not online, you can call us on 01475 6989.
Justin Moran, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Tech Talk on News Talk.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com. And now I'm joined once again by our dear friend, Claire O'Dowd, who has even more apps that we should add onto our phone. And even though it's Easter weekend, you've gone all healthy on us.
Yeah, well, full disclaimer, going to be looking at running apps, but I by no means call myself a runner. I happen to run at times in my life.
I'm the same, yeah.
But I have never taken off to, you know, the Wicklow Hills and done those inspiring photos in my running gear with my backpack. No. I've not done that, so full disclaimer for people. But some of the apps I'm looking at will have features that will be of interest to the actual proper runner, as well as people who've never actually even given it a go.
Yeah, so I'm kind of in the same boat in that I run every now and then. I go through notions. Like, I remember a while ago I went out and I bought myself new running clothes because I thought that makes me a runner. And then I didn't manage to motivate myself to actually leave the house. And I go through phases because I get them into review. I like wearing the wearables and they give you your step count, that kind of stuff. But I have to say the thing that I've been most loyal to in my non-existent running career is the applications. I find them, they're easy to use. Most of them are free and the information tends to be laid out quite nicely as well.
Yeah, I think they know that there's kind of a couple of markets there. You know, there's going to be people who are like, right, I'm doing this, you know, so they kind of will start off slow and there's kind of usually training plans that will get you from zero to wherever you want to go.
Yeah, there's the couch to 5K type thingies, which are nice as well. But you've picked out some of your favourites here.
Yeah, so the couch to 5K is probably something that people have heard a lot, and it's basically just a programme of kind of like that, getting you from not running at all to the 5K, which I think can sound like something that's going to be
colossal,
you know, really, really difficult. Yeah. And yeah, you're setting yourself up for a punishment, you know. But for myself, probably a couple of times over the last 5 years, say, I've gone back to this app and I feel like it's sort of my security blanket a little bit. It's the Get Running app. And I think that the thing that really makes it work for me and helps me to commit to it is the simplicity. Because like that, I know I'm queen of avoidance when it comes to exercise. It'll be like, I'll just have to go and buy the new runners. I'll just go and have to buy the new jacket. I'm sure my headphones aren't working, you know, and it's kind of all about the planning. And usually the actual exercise is a couple of steps into it. But the thing about the Get Running app is it's really, really simple. There's literally 9 weeks of running. It's 3 runs a week. And they're 30-minute workouts. So literally you leave your house, you're back in 30 minutes. But what I find lovely about it is that there's just this really simple little kind of map scale thing that'll kind of be like, you're on run 2 of week 3 and that kind of thing.
Okay.
But it's just so doable. I mean, the first week is you're running for a minute and then you're walking for 2 minutes to recover.
And does it tell you that type of thing? Yeah.
Yeah. So
okay.
There's like a human coach, and I know a lot of the running apps have sort of like an accompaniment or a coach, but this one is studio recorded and it genuinely feels like a human. Like it's an English lady. She's always there for me. No, it's really, really encouraging, and I find it quite natural in that, you know, if you've just started again and suddenly you're like, oh my God, I'm 45 seconds into my 1 minute run, which like should feel like nothing, but sometimes it can feel really difficult.
Yeah, especially when you're going back to it as well. Like the first run, because I went through a phase a few years ago, I did a 10K and I trained for about 3 weeks and I thought that I was superhuman. Yeah. Now, I nearly died at the end of the 10K, but we won't focus on that. And like, I really enjoyed running back then, and then I didn't do it for ages. And then last year I went back to running and I thought, okay, well, look, I've done 10K. So I physically and mentally know I can do it. So I need to just leave the house. But like that, I ran for about 35 seconds and I'm not being dramatic. I was
so out of breath. I was so aware of like how heavy my body felt in terms of feet hitting the pavement. And I didn't have a wearable or an app or anything with me. And I just, I lost motivation. I lost interest. I ended up just walking.
Yeah, totally. Like, and this is, I think that's what it is when you need that little bit. Come on, you can do it. 15 seconds left. You're like, yeah, I can. 15 seconds. I can do 15 seconds. And also at the end is like a nice little message like, well done. You've done 6 runs today. You ran for 18 minutes in total. Now you can stretch and enjoy the rest of the day knowing that you've done your run. And it's like, yeah. But
nice.
I think as well, the fact that it's... not overcomplicated. And if you are starting from nothing, sometimes going into the more complicated apps can just be like, what is this thing? What run should I be doing? Where should I go? You know, and the nice thing that I like about this as well is you can listen to whatever you want. So podcasts, Spotify, the radio, whatever you want to listen to. And it just pauses for the coaching. So it just pauses and then returns back to what you've been listening to. Because sometimes in the past, I think the previous version used to fade. Yeah. And sometimes if you were listening to a podcast, which I often would do, it's two voices talking over each other and it can just get quite annoying.
Okay, so that's called Get Running, and that's, is it free?
No, it's actually $3.50.
okay.
But it does have family sharing, so I think it's up to 6 devices on Apple that can use that. So
okay, cool. So if you do want to get the house moving, and as I said, on Easter weekend, that is probably not a bad thing to consider. So we're going to move on to your next one, which is one that I'm quite familiar with, in that it's Map My Run.
Yeah, this one it seems to be massive, and I think anywhere I've ever lived or been away, when I was in my proper running days, got to say I'm only on week 3 of that app, so I'm hoping to get back into properly using Map My Run. But yeah, so I suppose it's all based around GPS, and it's just basically tracking, the basics of it is that it's tracking where you're running. And it's really nice if you're looking for a different route, or you're kind of like, if you've got a target in your head that like, today I want to do a 5k, today I want to do a 6k, you can just go into the map, look for local runs that have been logged by other users. And it's used so widely that I've never seen an area that hasn't had a couple of runs.
Yeah,
like it's really 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 popular. Obviously, like a lot of these apps that are going for a long time, there's a lot of different ways you can use it. So you can kind of set yourself up to use a program. You can program your own runs, you can share your runs, and then there's also communities and challenges. And you know, if you're really into it, you can use it as much or as little as you want. A lot of the time for myself, because of the apps that I use don't have the tracking, I'll kind of put that on so that just out of interest, you'll know how far you've actually run in that space of time. And it's kind of gives you a lot more information than say the regular health app would on your phone, you know. So it's kind of, you can see where you've been, and
it's more in depth basically. I like that. I know that somebody is going to tweet in or email in right now going, proper runners don't bring their phones when they're running.
Well, yeah,
which is true, but this is the, like, we've Claire gave the disclaimer at the beginning, we are not professional runners, we're not professional athletes, we're people who dabble in running. And I actually really enjoy running, because it's one of the few times where, although my phone is like, you know, on my armband or in my pocket, I'm not looking at a screen. You can kind of just have that bit of headspace, which is so important, because it's very hard to come by.
Yeah.
So yes, full disclaimer, we are not professional runners. We are people recommending applications for people who want to get into running or get back to running. So Map My Run sounds good, but the next one on your list is my favorite.
Is it? Runkeeper?
Yeah.
Yeah, like when you're looking around, it kind of seems like people are in two camps, and you're either a Map My Run person or a Runkeeper person. And I suppose I'd very limited interaction with this one. I'd heard of it, but I actually went and got it obviously for this piece. And I think that even just from first impressions, it looks neater and cleaner and easier to use and kind of less complicated, I think.
Yeah, it's very, because that's literally the reason why I went for it over Map My Run. Because Map My Run, you know, the people on Facebook who put up photographs of the routes that they've run and that kind of stuff, they usually do that from Map My Run. With Runkeeper, when I logged in, I just found it so much cleaner. And like that, I like the little motivational coach, and I like the time checks as well. So it'll tell you when you've been running for 5 minutes, and it'll tell you when you've been doing, like when you've done another kilometer or whatever. And I just find it non-invasive, but also then really helpful.
And so many of those voices and coaches, I think, kind of come down to you as a person and what annoys you and what doesn't it?
Yes, it really does.
I found though in my area, Runkeeper didn't have as many saved runs. And I suppose that wouldn't really matter if you're familiar with where you are staying and where you live. But I've just moved to a new area, and and it's much more has more rural surrounds, so I would be starting from nothing. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to have the runs on Map My Run
okay.
that aren't there on Runkeeper yet. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen.
It may come eventually, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now Runkeeper is free and you can log different things in it, and I think you can also use it for different sports as well, but I literally just use it for a little bit of a run.
Yeah. Seems to be a lot going on there. Like with Map My Run, it's kind of like the more you use, the more you unlock. You know, there's so many features there in it that I think, can be daunting. So,
and I really do think a lot of these, they do, as you say, have a lot of features. And I think it's worth trying out a free app like this before you go and buy a wearable or before you invest too much. Because, like, as I said at the beginning, I've made that mistake of going out and buying ridiculously expensive runners and like pure Notions running tops, thinking that, you know, well, this is my life now. I am a runner. And then you use them twice and then they kind of just sit in the hall. So I think, you know, trying out the free apps, like make sure you're dedicated to the running and you're going to keep it up before going and spending hundreds and hundreds of euros on the watches and the different wearables that can then pair up. So if you do have a Garmin or a Fitbit, very often these apps will talk to it and feed it information across. But it's just worth having a go running with your phone to compile the information before you spend a lot of money.
Absolutely. And I think running as well is something that should be really simple. If you're already bringing a phone and an app, I think that's for a lot of people that can be enough, you know. I mean, it's you shouldn't overcomplicate it, because again, maybe that'll just turn into a bit of exercise avoidance.
Exactly, it's a pure ordeal. In terms of the Nike Plus Run Club app,
Well, this is something that's been around for years. Back in my heyday, 4 years ago, when I was able to run 5K, there's some lovely playlists. Obviously, Nike have a big budget, big reputation, so they can kind of call in the big guns. So they have original running playlists that are kind of mixes that are put together by artists. And then they've also got like professional athletic coaching. One that I used to love was, which is still there, it's an LCD sound system original run. So it's like 45 minutes. And it's funny because you get used to it and you're kind of like at the same point in your run at the same song. So it can wear thin a little bit, but then obviously that's just up to you to go and look for more playlists.
Yeah.
There's so many of them there. And then there's also, as I said, professional athletes kind of doing guided runs, so kind of coaching you. So they'd be coming in with the little stats about your progress and about how far you've run, and kind of just pointers about, you know, stretching and about how to improve your pace and that kind of thing. They have a big push on at the moment with Mo Farah. So, I mean, obviously that's distance
goals,
running.
Yeah.
But they do kind of put their runs into categories like that. So kind of they do recovery, speed and length.
Okay.
So there's a lot of that going on. But another thing that they've been doing lately is kind of going further into the field of guided runs. So apart from kind of having athletes, they've teamed up with, you know, the mindfulness app Headspace.
Yes.
And they've worked on 3 guided runs there. And in the same way that the Get Running app kind of guides you and coaches you, this is just a mindfulness coach. So it's kind of 3 runs that you can kind of set off on, continue listening to your own music or one of their playlists. Also, there's got the GPS mapping system there, so you can kind of go in afterwards and see where you've
run
on the
map. So this kind of has a lot. It seems like it has elements of everything, but then some more as well, like of the other apps that we've spoken about, but then it kicks it on a little bit further. How much does this one cost?
This one's free as well.
Oh, no way.
Yes, it's Nike. You
that's
know?
A lot for free though, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and it genuinely, I think from their point of view, it is a really nice, I find it a really nice experience to use. I kind of like the sort of celebrity and music element. And in return, I suppose you genuinely do feel like, as cliche as it sounds, part of the Nike Running Club, you know, and you might be more inclined to kind of think more favourably upon them when you're in the shop buying your new runners.
By your trainers, yeah. okay, and then you've got one more that I haven't heard of.
Yeah, just when you're looking into like the top app lists online, and this one keeps coming up, Strava. It started off, I think, as a cycling and running app, and it seems very popular amongst cyclists. But I think the thing, going back to the pro runners again, is that it has seems to have really good features for programming in your own workouts.
Okay.
And people seem to really like using this one for interval running. So I think interval running is something that you could really do with an app for, because you're not just going out and running. You have to be timing yourself and, you know, doing your sprints and then slowing down and doing your walks, and it's time to sprint again. And I think that Strava seems to be one that can be beneficial if you're doing that kind of training.
Cool. Okay. Well, so there seems to be something for everyone there. So whether you are looking to get from the couch to the 5K, right up to, you know, being part of the Nike Run Club, there's something for everyone there. But do let us know if you do have any apps, or if you want us to check any other aspect of life out in terms of applications, because, you know, that tagline, there's an app for everything. That is very much true. But Claire and I are happy to be the guinea pigs and try things out. You can email techtalk@newstalk.com. Claire O'Dowd, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's all we have time for, unfortunately, this week. If you want to listen back to the show, you can do so in full on newstalk.com, or you'll find the podcast in Pocket Casts or iTunes.